We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about medical marijuana. Currently, there are 16 states, most of them are in the West, 16 states that allow access to medical marijuana. The state of Illinois is not among them, although a couple of weeks ago, we came pretty close. In early January, a bill to allow access to medical marijuana failed narrowly in the Illinois House on a vote of 60 to 56. This was a bill that had been approved by the Senate already. That was back in 2009. The sponsor in the House of the legislation, Lou Lang, a Democrat from Skokie, has said that he plans to introduce the bill again this session. People who argue for the benefits of medical marijuana say that for people with a number of conditions, including AIDS, people undergoing chemotherapy for cancer, that for them, marijuana can help them control nausea and vomiting. It stimulates appetite. For people with glaucoma, it can help reduce pressure in the eye. Some people argue that it's good for general pain relief. However, the official position of the FDA and the federal government is that marijuana has no accepted value in the treatment of disease, and many people argue that there are undesirable side effects. And we have two guests here to try and talk about some of the issues associated with medical marijuana. They come at the issue from two different perspectives, two different areas of study. Dr. Gregory Carter is a physician. He's a clinical professor at the School of Medicine at the University of Washington. He's joining us here by telephone. Also by phone from the other end of the country is Harry Levine. He is professor of sociology at Queens College City University of New York. He has done a lot of writing on the subject of drugs and alcohol. He's won a number of awards for writing about the history of addiction, about alcohol prohibition and regulation, and about crack cocaine and the war on drugs. Now, as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. We hope people will try to be brief and be on the topic, but certainly your participation in the conversation is welcome. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. So if you're here where we are, use that one. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. That's the toll-free line. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that. And we do have email. So if you'd like to send your question by email, will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And we'll say hello to our guests. Dr. Carter, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and thanks very much for joining us. And Professor Levine, hello.
Hello, hello, good to be here.
Well, glad to have both of you with us. Let me start here by talking a little bit with Dr. Carter about medical marijuana. You would argue that, in fact, there are benefits for patients with variety of issues, benefits to having access to medical marijuana?
Well, I certainly would, but more importantly, the scientific medical literature has irrefutable evidence that cannabis has a considerable therapeutic benefit. I do want to state that marijuana is really an old Hispanic slang term. The proper medical term would be cannabis,
mm-hmm. All right.
And cannabinoids are the active ingredient. And it's been used for thousands and thousands of years as medicine. It was only since 1937 and really on the actions of just a few people, Harry Ainsinger being one of the more reputable reefer madness person, but it's really up until that point, cannabis had been used for thousands of years. There's evidence that was dated back over 3,000 years ago in China and parts of the Middle East.
Well, just let me again talk a little bit more about the applications. Maybe I will just ask, talk about some of the conditions that would benefit from people having cannabis as an option for a medication.
Well, a gentleman got a PhD degree working with me, Sunil Agarwal. He's an MD PhD now. And we did some clinical research. Part of it was review work, and then part of it was his own original work using my patient population, looking at the things that cannabis can be used for. and what the literature shows. I certainly think pain, chronic pain, is excellent literature, particularly neuropathic pain. There's a multitude now of what we call class one medical evidence, which means randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled trials. That means the patient doesn't know what they're getting, the researchers don't know what the patients are getting, and the data is kept blinded until the trial is completed. There's now a multitude of class one studies showing that cannabis works for neuropathic pain. There's also some excellent studies in spasticity, neurodegenerative disorders, actually some interesting stuff coming out now in Parkinson's, dementia, my own work in ALS. And then there's the sort of the stalwart work where it started out in loss of appetite and cancers, chemotherapy-associated nausea. So the literature is extensive. I don't think most people realize how extensive the literature is. And if you include the basic science and animal model work, it's quite impressive. Hmm.
Well, given that is the case, if indeed that is the case, why is it that the official position of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and indeed of the federal government seems to continue to be that cannabis does not have any accepted value in the treatment of disease? I mean, that's why it's listed as a Schedule I drug.
Well, let me run this by you, and I'm just in the midst of kind of writing a position on this. Consider that dronabinol, or Marinol, that is 100% THC. Now, THC tetrahydrocannabinol is the most psychoactive ingredient in cannabis. That is available by a Schedule III drug. So the Drug Enforcement Agency feels that 100% THC, that I could phone that in for you. I could phone in Professor Levine a prescription if you'd like this morning. That's a Schedule III drug. I mean, it can be phoned in. Refills can be authorized in advance. That's 100% THC. Now, most natural cannabis, at best, is 20%, usually considerably less than that in THC content. But more importantly, cannabis has a number of other therapeutic cannabinoids, and they all work in concert to produce the beneficial clinical effects. The other thing to remember is that there is no lethal dose for cannabis or any form of cannabinoid. It's physiologically and pharmacologically impossible to overdose on cannabis. It does not have to be smoked. I never recommend smoking. It can be inhaled via vaporization, which is around 200 degrees. It's a hot mist. It can be eaten or can be made into a liniment and applied, and it's well absorbed through the skin. I think the argument looking at dronabinol, that's a Schedule III drug, it's 100% THC, and the DEA signs off on that. But they look at cannabis naturally, and suddenly it becomes a dangerous drug. That doesn't add up.
Let me shift over and talk with a little bit here with Professor Levine, because it seems that there's an intersection here of medicine and law, and that's why we thought it'd be interesting to put the two of you guys together. You can't get away from the law enforcement issues that are related. And I guess that one of the questions I had for you is that why is it that some states, in fact, are taking a rather more relaxed attitude toward marijuana or cannabis, whatever you want to call it, that the federal government, and it seems no matter whether it's in the hands of Democrats or Republicans, has been steadfastly opposed to medical marijuana. So even the Obama administration has just taken a very hard line, much the same as previous Republican administrations. So the question is, why?
That's a very important question. It's a very big question, and it's not a medical question.
Mm-hmm.
There is absolutely, I agree completely, there's absolutely no doubt that cannabis is a powerful, useful medicine for specific conditions, for certain patients, and there are lots of them. And I've known some of them and seen them up close and in hospital rooms and so on. The struggles and conflicts over its legal status is a whole other story. And that's really the much larger story of the place of psychoactive drugs and substances in American society. And that really is the story that begins in the 19th century with the prohibition and temperance movements and the movements to ban alcohol, much more than anybody understands. The 20th century war on drugs, or the contemporary war on drugs, is really an extension of and development of the 19th century war on alcohol. And And there has long been a strong, you could call it puritanical, but not necessarily religious tradition in America of being sort of afraid of or fiercely anti-drugs. And one way to say this is Americans have long loved to hate drugs. And we are the only, we are the country that instituted national constitutional alcohol prohibition in the 1920s. And much of current contemporary drug policy is an extension of the alcohol prohibition years. Harry Anslinger, who you mentioned, who was the federal narcotics head for many, many years, began his career as a federal alcohol prohibition agent and commissioner and so on. So there's a great and famous sociologist and public health person named Alfred Lindesmith, who in a couple of books, one called The Addict and the Law and others, argued that drug policy is made or influenced strongly by either the medical profession, as it is in many countries and some countries, or by the police and the prosecutors. And in America, the police and the prosecutors have always had the upper hand. They still do. They have enormous power in Congress, much more than anybody understands. And that it is the police and prosecutors, the law enforcement, which is the fierce opponent of more tolerant policies with regard to medical marijuana and marijuana, mm-hmm. and who really lead the charge against it.
Well, just for a moment, again, to pick up on a point that that Dr. Kern made, it does seem odd that on the one hand you could have the one of the main active ingredients in cannabis, the chemical ingredients, and you could put that in a pill, and the government would find that acceptable with a prescription from a physician, and yet the natural product, the green leafy product, however it is you are going to administer that, that's a problem. Is that because there has been this long association of marijuana, cannabis with recreational use, and that's why the leaf is bad, but the pill is okay?
In large part, yes, of course. That marijuana is a prohibited drug. It's a street drug. And it's a legal drug, not just in the United States, but in every other country in the world. There are international treaties about this stuff. The international laws are about production, but not about distribution in that sense. And countries are free to regulate that however they want to. And most other modern Western industrial countries, Canada, Europe, Australia, are far more tolerant and sensible, public health oriented than the United States is. So yes, the answer is absolutely. Law enforcement fiercely fights for the right to go after marijuana users and marijuana, the cannabis, on the street. And it likes the arrests. It likes making them. It likes being able to accumulate the numbers. It likes, you know, seizing assets when it makes larger raids. And it wants to stay in the business. Hmm.
I don't know, if Dr. Carter, anything that you would want to add on to that?
Well, I certainly agree. I'm not a sociologist, but I have had several of my patients run into significant legal problems. And even if I have authorized their use, it becomes their issue to work their way out of it. And laws here in Washington State, there's a lot of ambiguity that allows loopholes for law enforcement to take advantage of. And, I totally agree with Professor Levine. This is really, the legal side of it is purely political and, you know, it is not based in science at all. In fact, that's been my one continuing statement. I try to stay out of the realm of politics, but, mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of the way the law is read, it has nothing to do with science. And I've tried to hammer that repeatedly. Let's let the science, the medical literature, dictate how we regulate drugs, not the issues that Professor Levine's talking about. And, you know, I hear over and over again, well, we've got dronabinol, we've got Marinol. The problem with Marinol is it's too strong. It's 100% of the most psychoactive ingredient in natural cannabis. And most of my patients can't tolerate it. It knocks them down. The other cannabinoids, actually there's a multitude of non-psychoactive, therapeutically beneficial ingredients, other cannabinoids in natural cannabis. Cannabidiol, cannabinol are two that come to mind. They have anti-seizure properties. They have neuroprotective properties. That's where I'm interested in. It looks like there's some a benefit for patients suffering with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease. There's also a body of literature now showing that the cannabinoids might be helpful in Alzheimer's dementia. And some of the cannabinoids have been shown to block the formation of plaque in that disease. So there's a big disconnect between what the science and medical literature says and what our laws reflect.
Let me introduce our two guests. We have, and then I have a caller here we'll get to. Dr. Gregory Carter is a clinical professor at the School of Medicine at University of Washington. He is also co-director of the Muscular Dystrophy Association Amyotrophic Lateral Sclerosis Center. He is a physician who believes that medical cannabis, should be a medical option for individuals, and it is there in Washington State. Also joining us from the other side of the country, Harry Levine. He's a sociologist at Queens College, City University of New York. His research and writing, much of it, has focused on drugs and alcohol, and has written about things like the history of addiction, about alcohol prohibition and regulation, and also about the war on drugs. And we are talking about medical marijuana. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller nearby in Belgium. Line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. And as a guest must should know, I regularly call into Mr. Inge's show and discuss this very situation. And I don't discuss it from the aspects of the legal aspects or the medical aspects. I discuss it from the fact that the whole problem boils down to one simple thing, and that is money. And it's plain and simple. There is huge, huge, huge profits involved in all drugs. Now, if I might make my position completely known, I think all drugs, no matter whether you call them illegal or illegal, should all be in a pharmacist. You deal with a pharmacist and a physician, and we'll solve the problem. Take the money out of it, because the money goes to the police. The money goes to the courts. The money goes to professionals of every sort. And then a huge amount of it goes as an untold tax to drug dealers who go to Mexico with it or wherever they may go with it. And I am still totally for prosecution of every drug dealer to the fullest extent of the law. I don't care what it is. But the problem is the money. And everybody in this discussion so far has danced around the fact about money. And if I might just add a small anecdote here, that's not quite the word I want to use, but a small comment on this is that in November I was in San Francisco while that was voted on for this legalization of marijuana. It failed. And it failed not because people didn't want marijuana. It failed because the people who were running the marijuana clubs did not want to reduce their profits. They lobbied strongly for it not to be passed because they knew as soon as it was decriminalized, they would lose a huge amount of money. And I happen to be looking at a pullout from one of the rags out there, and it's advertising all the marijuana clubs out there. And I look at this rag, and there's an advertisement, and it's the strangest thing about it. It's a beautiful, nice showroom with lots of counter space, and every person in the picture is less than 30 years old. And they're talking about chronic pain. Sir, I'm 63 years old. When I was 30, I didn't know what chronic pain was about. Nobody, when they're that young, deals with that much chronic pain.
Well, listen, the caller raises a number of issues, and it may be inevitable that we get into a conversation about drug legalization anytime drugs come up. And I'm not sure I don't want the program to become about that. But let me get a response, particularly from Professor Levine, and you can respond to that any way that you like.
I'd like to address it too.
And certainly, Dr. Carter, you can too. I'll start with
Professor. Go first and address the medical questions.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
So, well, let me stand back and just say, as a citizen, I actually agree with a lot of what that caller just said. I've always argued that pharmacists should be in this loop. I've testified to that thing, and I agree. Money runs everything. Let's just back off and get that out of the way. Money and power, politics, that's runs everything. Okay. My own research, done with Dr. Agarwal, this postdoc I had, we looked at a huge population of people that sought out authorization to use medical cannabis, because the party line from the government and what I think the impression of the public is that it's young males without medical conditions that seek authorization. Well, we actually did this in as scientific fashion as possible, and it turns out actually it's middle-aged women are the predominant users. Not by a lot, but young males represent about a quarter, maybe 20 to 25%. But it's in the overall population, it's slightly more women, and it tends to be middle-aged people. So I just wanted to get that out. That's published in the peer-reviewed medical literature. So that perception is wrong.
So just to draw a line under this, you're rejecting the idea, the argument that some people make that what this really is it's really people who would like to have marijuana for recreational use, and they manage to find a physician that will write them a prescription for some particular reason. The argument is that, well, you know, that really what they want is that they want it so that they can get high. You're saying from your experience that that's not the case.
I'm not saying that at all.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that rather than just call in from some other place and say, this is my opinion, I'm an expert. No, I approach this scientifically. This is not my opinion. This was based on scientific methodology, chart review, extensive review of the literature. This is, you know, as close as we can get to fact. It's not my opinion. It's based on reality. And that's a big issue. That's my whole argument all along, is what I am saying, I'm trying to avoid putting my opinion into this anywhere. I'm not, I'm a middle-aged guy, father of four kids. I'm actually a fairly conservative man. I'm approaching this as a scientist and a physician. So I'm trying not to put my personal bias into any of this. This is fact-based, as best as I can do it, and as best as the scientific methodology will allow me to.
And for just now, I'm curious for the middle-aged women that are interested in having this option of medical cannabis, what conditions do they have?
Fibromyalgia was a big one. That's a chronic pain condition. It's more common in women. Mm-hmm. It's also associated with sleep disturbance. Osteoarthritis, back pain, spinal stenosis. And these are, again, we required in this chart review, there had to be medical documentation of this. So if somebody said they had back pain, there had to be some documentation, either imaging studies, MRIs. They couldn't just walk into a physician's office and say, I have back pain. So we excluded any patients that there was no actual documentation of a problem.
All right. Let me go back here to Professor Levine, and I don't know if there's any you can address again the comments of the caller however you would like.
Yeah, I think that actually we've opened up a whole set of really powerful and provocative and complicated questions about the place of what we might call the currently illegal drugs, or cannabis in particular, in American society and in the world today. The question of who's going to the marijuana clinics, who's using the services of medical marijuana, is of course a big question, and there's no single answer to that question. It varies from place to place, from state to state, from city to city, depending upon the nature of the regulation of those clinics, and so on. There are studies, more and more and more, coming out of people. You know, there's very good records of these things. In many places, there's sophisticated, medical records of who the patients are and what they're about. And accident victims have chronic pain and are 20 years of age. And people who've fallen off of motorcycles and have been car wrecks and construction wrecks and so on. And so there's lots of pain patients, genuine suffering pain patients who are young and male who seek out remedies from marijuana. Are there also people who seek it to a medical marijuana card to avoid getting arrested if they should get stopped by the police? Sure. Absolutely, there are some people who do that. What's the ratio of the mix of those from place to place? That depends upon the place, but probably the answer is a lot. They're mostly patients. They're real patients who need relief from this stuff and so on. Coming back to the caller's question about absolutely, of course, money is involved in every piece of this operation. It's not the only motivator, and as his participation is probably not driven by money, and many of us who work on this are not actually financially rewarded for talking on NPR or writing about this stuff. So no, the money is not necessarily the motivation for lots of other people involved in this stuff. But I do absolutely believe that the whole criminal justice system, much more than anybody understands, operates on a financial incentive in a very odd way. Is in New York City, where I come from, for example, the marijuana arrests, the lowest level marijuana possession arrests, constitute 14% or 1 in 7 of all arrests for anything. New York City made 46,400 marijuana arrests in 2009, has made over 500,000 since 1997. These are serious arrests in which people are put in handcuffs, taken to jail, fingerprinted and photographed, spend 24 hours in custody, and wind up with permanent criminal records. And many other cities in America are making large numbers of these marijuana arrests. Why do the police departments do it? Well, there's a bunch of complicated reasons about that, but it is in the interest of police departments and for various constituencies within them to make these arrests. They allow supervisors to keep track of their officers. They allow officers to show they're being productive. It'll get police officers overtime. And very crucially, police departments get federal money through a program called Byrne Grants, B-Y-R-N-E. And they can use that money to buy all kinds of things, bullets and vests and overtime and computers, and then they have to show that they justify it in some way. And the current federal metric for justification is drug arrests, and so misdemeanor marijuana possession arrests wind up being used by police departments to justify how they have spent the millions of dollars of Byrne Grant money. That money has tripled in the last couple of years under the stimulus package. And so there is, indeed, a lot of money flowing to law enforcement, to prosecutors and police departments to make low-level marijuana arrests, and therefore they have a strong interest in getting and keeping marijuana criminalized. In California, in the Proposition 19 campaign and election, and I did some work around that as well, working with the NAACP, talking about the racial bias character of these arrests, is that it was very clear. Washington Post and lots of papers who were covering this stuff reported that the major leaders of the opposition to the proposition, the people who sought to stop this quasi-legalized system that they were going to be created in California, were the sheriffs, were the police departments, and were the prosecutors. And they were fighting hard to keep their control over this important activity for them.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. I have another caller. I do, however, here very quickly want to introduce again our guests. Maybe you've just tuned in. The last person you heard, that's Harry Levine. He's a professor of sociology at Queens College, City University of New York, has done a lot of writing and research on drugs and alcohol, writing about the history of addiction, about alcohol prohibition, about crack cocaine, about the war on drugs. Also joining us by telephone is Dr. Gregory Carter. He is a physician. He's a clinical professor at the School of Medicine at University of Washington. He's also co-director of the Muscular Dystrophy Association, Amyotrophic Lateral Sclerosis Center. We're talking about medical marijuana. It is legal in, by my count, I think 16 states. Most of them are in the western United States. Illinois is not one of them. However, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we came rather close earlier in the month. A bill that would allow medical access to marijuana narrowly failed in the Illinois House on a vote of 60 to 56. This was something that already has been approved by the Illinois Senate. That was in 2009. The sponsor of this legislation, his name is Lou Lang. He's a Democrat from Skokie. He said he will continue to introduce the bill until he can get it passed. So it's an issue no doubt we will be hearing more about here in the state of Illinois. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller from Normal, the town, not the organization, here at line number four. Hello.
Hi. I want to go back to the issue of middle-aged women using cannabis. My mother is 51. I also want to know if there's any research on the relationship between the use of cannabis and depression. So my mother is 51. She lives in California. She's been under lots of treatment for depression over the years, has a list of medicines she's used that's pages long. And the only thing that she's found that actually can get her out of bed and to be productive is marijuana. And I was wondering if there's been any research on the relationship between that and depression. Thank you.
All right. Well, Dr. Carter, that sounds like a question for you.
Sure. Well, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I have to get that out of the way. I'm really a neuromuscular physician, chronic pain. But the actual recent drive to legitimize medical marijuana really started with psychiatrists. Dr. Lester Grinspoon comes to mind. Dr. Todd McKeura also comes to mind. Todd's passed, but Lester is still with us. Both of them brilliant psychiatrists. And yes, there is good evidence that, well, of course we know that cannabis induces euphoria. But yes, no, it is a mood stabilizer. It's a mood elevator. You know, the interesting thing about its use in females, I think in my experience, women have a harder time with other pain medications, including opiates. And there's some literature also showing a difference in the way women express pain. Opiates, interestingly enough, so we're talking about opium derivatives. That would include morphine, codeine, oxycodone, OxyContin, those things. That's becoming an epidemic problem. Actually, prescription opiates have now, in Washington State, I know have surpassed motor vehicle accidents and also recreational drugs, including cocaine and heroin, as the primary cause of accidental drug overdose. And I think that's occurring in other states as well. If you think back to what Professor Levine said, and myself, I referenced Harry Ainsinger, if back in 1937, if we had not made cannabis illegal, over the last 75 years, we would have continued to develop cannabinoid medicines, because before that time, Eli Lilly and Merck Sharp Dohme, Park Davis, they all had prescription forms of cannabinoid-based medicine. And you can find these on the Internet. There's a Cannabis Medicine Museum website, and you can see tincture of cannabis, interestingly, for neuropathic pain. So they knew that back then, even before all these studies were done. So we're kind of reinventing something that's been used as medicine for thousands of years. But the point I'm getting to is God knows how many people have died from opiate, and I'm talking about prescription opiate overdose, that could have been prevented if we were using cannabinoid-based medicines, because you cannot overdose from any form of cannabinoid. You'll at worst fall asleep, and the half-life is typically 3 to 4 hours. You may have some weird dreams, but you will wake up, as opposed to opiates, which suppress your breathing, and people fall asleep and they don't wake up.
Mm. So just do you think that is it the case that the stigma attached to marijuana and the fact that it's listed on Schedule 1 by the federal government, those things, has that prevented research into the various compounds that are found in cannabis? Would people be looking at it more closely if we took a different sort of
posture? Without question. I mean, even just to do that chart review studies that I did with helping this gentleman get his PhD, we had to get an attorney on our team to get the human subjects approval and to get the study approved and funded. Yes, I mean, the legal arena does definitely impair research. And the federal government only allows you, if you're using cannabis, like in smoked cannabis, these trials, first of all, you don't have to smoke it, but that's still the way most of the trials are done, because the federal government controls what cannabis you use. They actually grow it down in Mississippi, and it's a very poor quality, and they produce the cigarettes that your patients use. So they control everything, and despite all that, the studies have still shown benefit. But most, medical growers, people that do it for themselves, can grow better quality medical cannabis than the federal government can. And by that, I also mean that the lower content of THC, higher content of cannabidiol and cannabinol and some of these other ones, there's a website also called Project CBD, which is aimed at getting higher strains of cannabis that have higher CBD content. CBD is non-psychoactive, but it's very effective at relieving pain and giving a number of other medical benefits. So, yes, the legal environment does hinder research. Some other things that people may not know is that, there's been several government-based commissions Mayor LaGuardia in New York did one back in the 1940s, and then more recently, Richard Nixon actually funded the Schaefer Commission, otherwise known as the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse. That was back in the early 70s. Their conclusion was that cannabis actually should be legal. They went beyond the medical use. They said cannabis should be legal for personal use. It should not be a legal offense. Casual distribution without exchange of money or remuneration should be completely legal. And, of course, that inflamed Nixon because he was very anti-drug, and he wouldn't let it go. He wouldn't even let it be publicly distributed. But now it's available if you search the web.
Hmm. We have some other callers. Let's talk with some more folks here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, fine.
A couple of comments here, and it might tie some things together legally and medically and politically. I'm somebody who suffers from syringomyelia. It's a fairly rare syndrome of the spine. It's caused by cysts that form either through birth defects or injury. I happen to have been injured. It does not respond well to opioids, for instance. So you really, you would have to take a whole lot of them before you help a whole lot with it. It's a kind of what's called central nervous system pain is what I've been told. And they just don't cross the blood-brain barrier well.
I'm very familiar with that. It's actually a disorder.
Yes. And it's something, I was a long-time cannabis user. I don't want to go into the details. Now I'm on dronabinol, which sort of helps. And as was mentioned, it's pure THC. Interestingly, all the non-psychoactive components, as you just mentioned, like CBD, are not legally available to me. And I think that's part of the problems that I'm dealing with in sort of the enforced switch of my medications. And one of the interesting things for residents of Illinois, it's my wife is an employee of the state of Illinois, and it's now costing them $1,800 a month for dronabinol, which is ridiculous because, well, let's put it this way, you could easily do it at home, period. What I would just want to say is it's a dumb policy. The current situation does not keep any medical patient from getting cannabis because, be frank, the drug war is a failure. It's an utter failure. Lots of other things we could say. Some have already been said. But, you know, we can't afford dumb policy these days. And I think Illinois really needs to get on board with that. That's about all I'm going to say. People need help out here, quite
right.
frankly.
Well, I appreciate the comment.
I'd like to comment on that if I could.
Yes, please.
Well, I'm very familiar with syringomyelia, and your caller brings up a good point. That's a neurological disorder, a spinal cord disorder. The cannabinoids, the active ingredients in cannabis, actually work by a specific receptor system in our body, and we make internal forms of cannabinoids. Most people don't realize that, even a lot of doctors. So we have systems in our body, including the motor system, mood state, coordination, appetite control, that's regulated internally by compounds known as endogenous cannabinoids or endocannabinoids, and endamamide is one. So our bodies produce cannabinoids, and they control these systems. There's a lot of cannabinoid receptors in the gut. So when a patient is using cannabis, natural cannabis, or even dronabinol for that matter, it goes into the body and works via this very specific receptor system. And we know now very specifically how cannabis works. We know what the receptor systems do. We know what cascade of events it triggers. Now contrast that to, let's say antidepressants, for example. A lot of the country is on antidepressants these days. Turns out they don't work any better than placebo, exercise, or, counseling, but that's one of the most widely prescribed drugs in the United States. They supposedly work by increasing serotonin or possibly norepinephrine, supposedly, but that's never been definitively proven. Actually, the whole compound of drugs known as benzodiazepines, that includes Valium and all the derivatives thereof, very gray how they work. These are non-receptor-based drugs. They're what we call dirty drugs. They hit a lot of different areas of the body. And incidentally, those are why they're toxic. You can easily overdose on antidepressants. You can easily overdose on benzodiazepines. You can easily overdose on almost any prescription drug, for that matter. I don't want to get into that too much. But in terms of our knowledge scientifically about how cannabis works, it's way beyond most prescription drugs, way beyond that.
We're coming down to the point where we have about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers. Professor Levine, yeah, go ahead, sure.
Yeah, I just want to provide a little bit more political, legal, policy context.
Mm, sure.
For what, you know, in a sensible world would simply be basically a medical and scientific discussion, which is what this ought to be about. And when that happens, as lots of studies and books and so on have found, that marijuana is an effective medicine for a whole range of conditions and that the only question is for which ones under what circumstances and how much and how do you do it and so on. But the truth, of course, and the reason why this is a big question is because the substance of cannabis is illegal. It is prohibited, and there is a huge federal and state and local police departments, and in effect, a domestic army, and not to mention an international one, which is very, very well funded to the tune of many billions of dollars, that is devoted to suppressing the use of this. Now, it doesn't work, of course. Marijuana, cannabis, is the most widely used illegal drug in the world, everywhere. And then the only question is how in the world that stuff is handled. One of the reasons why medical marijuana has become a big issue in the United States, but not so much, for example, in Northern Europe, Western Europe, and many other places, is because they don't enforce the possession laws in the same way that the United States does. We make 750,000 arrests a year, mostly arrests with handcuffs and people go back to police stations for possessing small amounts of marijuana. Most of the European countries don't do that. They have either formally or informally decriminalized the use of marijuana. So the truth is that it doesn't raise the law enforcement issues in quite the same way that it does here. Mm-hmm. In a humane world, you wouldn't need the whole system of separate medical dispensaries to deal with marijuana. But it would be dealt with through the radical channels of prescription medicines and pharmacies, or in some other parallel universe through in the same way that hard liquor is, and through liquor stores, and people could buy it the same way that they buy alcohol and use it in much the same legal standing. So it is the legal issue that is critical here to all of this stuff, and the question about that's changing in America. It's really quite a remarkable thing that's happened. I mean, California had an initiative on the ballot in 2010. This is the biggest state in the United States. It's got 40 million people. It's the eighth largest economy in the world, and they were seriously debating legalizing marijuana, allowing people to grow it at home and to buy it, that local governments could license it and sell it. It would have been quite a revolutionary thing if it had passed, and it was fiercely opposed and fought, not just by some local marijuana growers and dispensaries, but by, as I say, the law enforcement machine. Yeah. There's a lot of good commentary that came out of it, and one of it was a really good essay in Time magazine, which pointed out that that from the results of that election, one found that majority of people over 50 years of age, and getting and higher as you went up, voted against Proposition 19, against the decriminalization and legalization, and that people under 40 years of age voted overwhelmingly in favor of it. And the Time magazine essayist concluded that when you have the older people going one way and the younger people going the other, it is over time, it's the younger people's one that's going to happen. That's what's going to be victorious. And there's no question about the fact that, like the civil rights movement, like gay rights, this is an issue whose time is coming, will come. It seems to me that the humane and sensible thing to do is to try to hasten that day and reduce the amount of suffering and victimhood that results from the current system, but that there is absolutely a movement that is going on right now. I mean, really, it's quite a dramatic thing that's happening in America to move the agenda with regard to cannabis reform.
We have a couple minutes left. I want to try to get maybe at least one more caller here. We'll go over to Indiana, line two.
I can't understand the dog.
Maybe let's go to McLean County. How about line number three? Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I stopped using non-medical cannabis years ago because it makes me paranoid. And so I'm listening to this.
Is the caller still there?
With what was some despair. Because
I couldn't hear her.
You dropped out on us there for just a moment. Can you start again for us?
Yeah, I stopped using non-medical marijuana years ago because it makes me paranoid. And I don't get high, I just get paranoid. And I'm listening now that I'm in nearly 60 and starting to develop chronic pain. I was feeling really depressed about how effective marijuana was because it makes me paranoid, and I'm not sure that would be worth pain control. But did I hear correctly that there are some strains of cannabis that don't have the psychoactive part, so they would kill pain without inducing, in my case, paranoia?
Yes, that's correct. Actually, paranoia is a THC effect.
Okay.
And I want to make clear, too, and I have never said that cannabis is a perfect drug. It has side effects. It's not the answer to everyone's ills. I've also said that in my papers and on record. And people can get psychologically addicted to it, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to make sure that's clear. Although people get addicted to anything, and there's, you know, certain fixed rate of addiction, it doesn't really matter what the substance is. But yes, there are strains of cannabis that do not cause paranoia. That's a THC effect.
Okay. Well, that's very encouraging then, that maybe 10 years down the road when I'm in a lot more pain, there might be an effective remedy that I'll be happy using. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
So,
this caller's experience points out another sort of funny contradiction in the way that drugs are talked about, which is that the part of the scare stories that keep the current system in place and the horror stories is that marijuana is terribly addicting and will ruin people's lives and that it leads to addiction to other drugs. The reality from every national drug survey going back to the dawn of time is that most people who try marijuana, not only don't they wind up using heavily cocaine or some other drugs, that most people who try marijuana don't even go on to use marijuana heavily, and that some large percentage of people don't like marijuana as a recreational drug, and it, partly because it makes people nauseous, partly because people don't like to inhale smoke into their lungs, so that there are real limits to the spread of marijuana. In fact, it's one of the problems of marijuana compared to, say, wine or beer. It's a much less appetizing or interesting drug to large numbers of people. It will always be a minority drug to some extent.
Yeah. Just real quick here, and unfortunately I can't give you a lot of time, but this does get at something I didn't want to ask, and I was hoping maybe Professor Levine would know, and that for people who argue against medical marijuana, their concern seems to be that if that happens for a variety of reasons, because of relaxation of attitudes toward it and maybe because of control issues, that somehow in places where the concern is that recreational use, unauthorized use, will increase. Is there any reason to believe in those states where they have legalized medical marijuana that non-medical use of the drug increased?
I can answer that.
You can't. All right. Well, Dr. Carter, go for
no,
it then.
No, there's no evidence whatsoever. And actually, there was a little experience back in the 1970s. In 1975, the state of Oregon actually completely legalized marijuana, completely. Not just medical, but completely legalized it, decriminalized it for 1 year. And there was no evidence that it increased use whatsoever. Of course, it got repealed for other reasons. But yeah, there's no evidence that it's a gateway drug. There's no evidence that in areas where it's legal, the use increases. And I think Professor Levine's points are very well taken. Mm. And I also want to say that it's medical use. You do not have to be high or intoxicated to get a therapeutic medical effect. And I've written papers on how to titrate it and dose it. So you can use cannabis medically without getting intoxicated.
And also without smoking it.
That's correct.
There are other methods of administration that don't involve smoking. So and in fact, I think there are people who would argue that that's actually even better not to inhale that smoke into your lungs.
I never recommend smoking anything. Cannabis smoke doesn't cause cancer, but it can cause bronchitis. You know, one thing we didn't touch on today, too, and I'll close real briefly, is that now that Congress is rereading the Constitution, our founding fathers, most of them had hemp farms. Hemp is an indigenous plant to North America. It was, you know, we can't even grow hemp in the United States, so our hemp products are imported from Canada. Your farmers in Illinois could be growing hemp. Hemp was re-legalized in the 40s to make clothing for our sailors. In fact, I have my father's sailor uniform made out of hemp because hemp grows faster than cotton. It doesn't delete the soil. It can be regrown without having to turn the fields off for a year.
That's
a whole other topic.
I'm going to and we're going to have to simply stop because we're here at the end of the time. And on what I need to do is say thanks to the guest, Dr. Gregory Carter, clinical professor at the School of Medicine at University of Washington. Dr. Carter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Harry Levine, he's professor of sociology, Queens College, City University of New York. Professor Levine, thank you.